The 28-point peace plan between Russia and Ukraine has been whittled down now to 19 points, according to Volodymyr Zelensky. And the question is, are we any closer to a peace? Are the Europeans ready to accept it? Are the Ukrainians ready to accept it? Is Russia ready to accept it? And then the question is, while we're trying to get peace here, what about in the Middle East? Because that is could be on the brink of yet more violence. And then a whole new one in the Caribbean could break out in Venezuela. All of this today we're going to discuss with one of the best guests that we ever have, Colonel Douglas McGregor, defense and foreign policy analyst, former advisor to the Secretary of Defense, highly decorated combat veteran and friend of the show. Doug, welcome back.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, listen, we got a lot to cover here, and it even though, you know, in the United States here, we're getting ready for Thanksgiving, and that always kind of things always ramp down, and everybody kind of stops paying attention to stuff, but holy cow, lot going on in the world today. We need to stay on top of this. Let's start in the Russia-Ukraine situation here. There is lots of disputes, even in the United States, not just between the Republican Democrats, but even between the Republicans and the Republicans about where we're going. There is a current issue between many in the Republican Party and the administration. J.D. Vance is upset and snaps at Mitch McConnell, a senator from Kentucky, because of his aggravation on the peace plan here. This is what Senator McConnell talked about just a couple of days ago. He says that the president of the United States is right, that Biden's weakness emboldened enemies like Putin, but those who think pressuring the victim and appeasing the aggressor will bring peace are kidding themselves. Which difficult decisions are we presenting to Russia to make? How does limiting Ukraine defense against future aggression increase the likelihood of an enduring peace? The prize and stability of peace matters, and our credibility is on the line. Allies and adversaries are watching. Will America hold firm against aggression, or will we reward it? What do you think about that logic voiced by McConnell, which is echoed by quite a number of folks we show here in the United States?
Well, there is no logic to it. And the man is delusional. Let me explain what I mean by that. If you go back to the decision to offer Austrian neutrality to the Soviet Union, all of these issues came up for discussion. And remember that this is in 1955, just 10 years after the end of the Second World War. And the Russians were still at that point, understandably sensitive to the possibility that Germany, Austria, and the German-speaking world in general might recover and pose another threat to the Soviet Union. The outcome was, of course, that you got the Austrian state treaty arrangement, and the Austrian state treaty included very definite limitations on Austrian military power and excluded any foreign forces from entry into Austria or any permanent presence of any kind on Austrian soil. This worked out very, very well. In fact, at the time, President Eisenhower said, well, this is wonderful because we simply don't have the military resources, the manpower, the capabilities to defend numerous countries all across Europe against the potential offensive operations of the Soviet military. So let's get Austria, quote unquote, off the board. Let's just take them off, make them neutral. Then subsequently, he said, we should look at a way to neutralize the rest of Eastern Europe if it can be done as the best means of securing peace. Now, that was in 1955, after the largest and most destructive war in human history. Here we sit in 2025 listening to people who consider themselves to be bright and smart and knowledgeable tell us the exact opposite, that if Ukraine is not allowed in any way to maintain whatever military power it wants, that then it will never be safe from Russia, instead of understanding that that's exactly how we got into the war to begin with. We went in there, we invested billions of dollars, we built the most modern, well-equipped, well-trained army in NATO. And what's the result? Well, Russia was very threatened, and understandably so, because almost immediately after the coup in 2014, what did the Ukrainians start to do? They started shelling Luhansk and Donetsk. So the war got started almost immediately after we installed air puppets in Kiev. These people on the Hill are out of touch with reality. They do not understand the issues at stake. They think we are stronger and more powerful than we are. and they grossly overestimate European capacities. So it's just a statement of the absurd. It bears no influence on reality whatsoever.
And so I guess the question is going to really be, to what extent does the vice president, and therefore the president, actually stick to their guns? Because there is evidence that maybe they're not sticking already. So there was, I think it was on the 23rd, Secretary of State Rubio came out and had a big conversation after they'd been talking in Geneva with a number of the stakeholders on the Western side. And he says, hey, I think we're close to an agreement. I think we're really close to having this knocked out. After that conversation yesterday, the Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament made this statement about where they are on the deal.
Ukraine is ready for substantive negotiations on ending the war, including at the level of leaders. At the same time, we must designate the Ukrainian red lines, which no one has the right to cross, neither physically, nor legally, nor morally. No legal recognition of the Russian occupation of Ukrainian territories. No restrictions on Ukraine's defense forces. No veto on Ukraine's right to choose its future alliances. Any genuine peace process must be based on a very clear principle: nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, and nothing about Europe without Europe.
Doug, those alleged red lines there are the complete repudiation of what was allegedly in the Trump-authored 28-point peace plan. And then now, as Gary just showed you with that headline just a minute ago from CBS, apparently we're close. We have agreed on the points. So the question is, who's the points that we agreed on? Was it Trump's, or was it as demonstrated there by that member of the parliament?
Well, if you go back and look at the people that supposedly cooked up this agreement, and that's primarily Mr. Witkoff and a gentleman named Kirill something, I can't pronounce the last name.
Dmitriev, I think.
Dmitriev, yes. This whole thing is vacuous and meaningless. Why? Well, if you don't talk to the people in charge in Russia to begin with, and at least established the foundations for some commonality of interest and agreement, what do you expect to happen? Well, I think you expect nothing to happen. I think Witkoff was talking to somebody that had worked with Goldman Sachs and BlackRock. Man lives primarily in Palo Alto. He doesn't represent anyone in Moscow. As far as I can tell, he doesn't represent anybody in Kiev. So what do we get? We get this nothing burger, if you will, of 28 specious points that are irrelevant, that are not even open for discussion. That's the first part. Secondly, from the very beginning, I have wondered why President Trump pays as much attention to the Europeans and NATO as he does. Why? Because the European states and NATO are analogous in many ways to the Greek city-states at the time of the Roman Empire. Initially, the Greek city-states found this Philip of Macedonia, who was a descendant of Alexander the Great and his father, Philip, reprehensible. They couldn't get rid of them. They were an oppressive, tyrannical group. And so they invited the Romans to come into Greece to help rid themselves of the Macedonian menace, which they did. The Romans threw them out, defeated the Macedonians, liberated Greece. And everything was fine until the Greek city-states decided to fight with each other. The Romans intervened again and said, look, we didn't liberate you so that you could kill each other and disrupt trade and commercial development in the Eastern Mediterranean. So we're taking over. We're running the place, which is effectively what we did after World War II. We said, we're not going to allow anybody in Europe to fight anymore. We're going to establish peace. These are the guidelines. The Greek city-states became irrelevant because they were just other members of the greater Roman Empire. Well, this is going to sound harsh, but that's true for Europe and the United States today. And the Europeans have gone to great lengths to make themselves permanently dependent upon us for their survival, not just militarily, but I would argue also economically. Now, that may change as a result of the recent events, but why should President Trump pay any attention to the NATO allies? He should get them into a room and say, this is it. No more war. We've had it. We're going to end it. These are the terms to which we are prepared to agree. If you don't like it, Well, there are things we can do because you are dependent upon us. We can make life very miserable for you. That's what Eisenhower did in the aftermath of the Suez Crisis. He made it clear to the British and the French and others, if you don't get the hell out of Egypt and let this thing alone, then we are going to take measures against you, which are going to pull the rug out from you, out from under you financially. I guess my point is that for all the bluster, all the big talk that comes out of Trump, he behaves like a pussycat. Oh, won't you please sign on for this? We'd like your input. We want you to join us. The hell with that. We have no interest in this war in Ukraine. We never have. We have no interest in Ukraine other than stability and peace. That's what should have been stated right up front. Instead, we were dragged into this ridiculous anti-Russian crusade, largely because of the people that were running the Biden administration, and many of the people running this administration are no different. They adhere to the same principles, the same thinking. You know, it's not just Israel über alles. It's we're going to demand that Russia commit suicide before we do business with them. It's insane. It's all got to change. But he doesn't seem to be a free agent. He doesn't seem to be able to act decisively on his own in the interests of the American people.
Well, and so that's part of what's puzzling, because according to the reports, this 28-point peace plan wasn't just authored by Witkoff and some of his buddies, but apparently what's being reported was that Trump himself gave personal direction that this is what I want. So whenever, however they were arrived at, Trump said, yes, these are the 28 points I want. Then Witkoff goes to Europe. You have Secretary of State Rubio goes to Europe. And then all of a sudden things start changing. And as you've talked about many times, one of the problems with the current president is that he's really influenced by whoever the last person that talked to him was. And along with whatever was happening in Europe with Rubio et al., you also had Brother Jack Keane talking on American radio television, apparently also trying to influence Trump in a different direction.
We've got Putin on the other side of it, and the reality is he has not taken one single step towards a temporary ceasefire or a peace deal whatsoever. Where he is, he still believes that eventually he's going to break the will and resolve of the United States and the Europeans and the Zelensky government, and he will eventually have his way here. And that is the determined process that we're on here. Putting this peace plan together, hopefully with good security guarantees that certainly favor Ukraine as a result of the process, and some other things that we can do to help Ukraine, will convince Putin that negotiation is the best answer.
It's hard to put into words how the logic that's flowing from that we want to take, and you said it perfectly a second ago. What he is asking Russia to do is to commit suicide from a position of strength and do everything counter to their own interest, and then go with the peace from the guy who is on the lower side who doesn't have the capacity to change it. What in the world is going on in the Western thinking right now?
Angela Merkel, as Chancellor of Germany, and I'm by no means a fan of Angela Merkel. She did more to destroy Germany by opening its borders in 2015 than I think anybody since Adolf Hitler took Germany to war against the Soviet Union. But Angela Merkel did grow up in East Germany for the most part. She did learn something about the Russians. And she said on more than one occasion while she was chancellor that we need to understand that President Putin cannot conceive of any circumstances under which he cannot win a war in Ukraine. And she was right. If there's a war Russia knows it can win, not just Vladimir Putin, but everyone, it's a war on Russia's doorstep. It's a war in eastern Ukraine or even in western Ukraine, because you're talking about a force that can be built up and then ultimately commutes to the fight. Who cannot win in Ukraine? We can't. We're too far away. We can't mass the forces. We can't build up to do anything. And the Europeans, they lack both the resolve, the will, and the understanding to field a force that could defeat the Russians. So it's all nonsense. Anything that Jack Keane says about the war in Ukraine is nonsense. Forget it. It's a dead end. We can't win it. Now, I think privately there have been moments of lucidity when Donald Trump has effectively said that, when he said in the Oval Office to Zelensky, you don't have any cards to play. What he didn't know is that his donors were on Zelensky's team, and his donors were going to tell him, you have to stick with this, Donald, because his donors, these are the ones driving us to war with Iran, driving us to war with anybody Israel doesn't like, also hate Russia. Okay, it's not an American interest. But whose payroll are all of these people on? That's the question you have to ask. I wish every time Fox or CNN or somebody brings up an individual and puts the name up there, they should put beneath it sources of income. What are the sources of income? Well, it's probably Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, AIPAC, or some derivative of AIPAC. I mean, come on, let's be honest. Who is funding these talking heads? If Americans understood that, they would step back in horror and suddenly realize that none of these people are saying or doing anything that is in the interest of the United States. And frankly, this has been the problem from the very beginning. I saw this back in the 90s. The view was, it doesn't matter. We can sell our country down the road because it doesn't hurt us. We're great. We're powerful. No one can ever touch us. Nothing can ever harm us. So what difference does it make? What difference does it make if another few million illegals come into the country? What difference does it make if we embroil ourselves in conflicts in Africa, Asia, or Latin America, or Eastern Europe? Because we're great. We're powerful. Nobody can challenge us. Nobody can touch us. Well, that's wrong. It's dead wrong. And we are more vulnerable today than ever in our history. We have created a situation of extreme danger to the United States, not just militarily, but financially and economically. You know, someone was talking to me earlier today and said, you know, the problem, Doug, and this is someone overseas who's very heavily engaged in the banking industry. He said, you know, when people look at us and at the United States and then they look at China, they conclude very quickly that China's economy, which is doubled, tripled in size since 2005, given its population, given the successful implementation of state-sponsored capitalism in China, even though China has a great deal of debt, just as we do, everyone is confident that the Chinese economy is going to outgrow its debt. No one believes, based upon what they're seeing inside the United States today, that the United States has any chance whatsoever of growing out of its debt. Absolutely not. And so the world is moving away from us into this thing called BRICS. And that puts everything at risk. So my point is that the people talking in these terms are not only dangerously wrong, they're putting the country in severe jeopardy. Because what we need now more than ever before in our history is peace and stability. The stability that comes from peace that is the foundation for prosperity. We need to dump all of this overseas and look very carefully at what we need to do here at home to rebuild our economy, rebuild this financial system to make sense, to end the financialization of our economy, to start producing and building things, which we have not done for decades.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And in order to make that vision come to pass, you got to have a leader with the courage to make hard decisions. And unfortunately, President Trump, even though he came into office with that reputation, certainly has not produced. And I want to show kind of a graphic contrast, if you will. You mentioned a minute ago that Oval Office meeting in late February where President Trump had that big blow up with Zelensky and told him, you don't have cards and you don't have leverage, etc. Had he acted on what you said he should have done in January and just said, all right, here's the deal. This is over. Our support is going to come to an end on this date unless you come to an agreement that we can live with, or you're on your own if you want to fight. That's what should have happened then. You said that many times. But instead, after this now, all these months later, now into November, this 28-point peace plan that he comes up with, now then that's been shredded, and you heard the parliament member there in Ukraine after meeting with Trump's negotiators said that none of the issues you wanted are on the table, and then last night, here's what Zelensky is now saying.
Ukraine is not alone, and this is important. Our teams have already reported today on the new draft of steps, and this is truly the right approach. Sensitive issues. Delicate issues I discuss with President Trump. Ukraine will never be an obstacle to peace. This is our principle, a common principle. And millions of Ukrainians expect and deserve a decent peace. We will do everything for this. We're ready to work as quickly as possible, and we also understand how many interests surround Ukraine. And, above all, there is an interest from Russia in derailing this chance for an agreement and in prolonging the war.
So he's trying to tell everybody, and of course he's been meeting with a lot of Europeans as well, that, hey, it's the Russians who are the problem, and they don't want the deal that we want, and we'll have peace as long as they're on our terms. Which means, correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that the, whatever President Trump intended, it's Zelensky and his European leaders who are running the show.
Zelensky and his government are not only a catalyst for conflict with Russia in a permanent sense. Frankly, they are responsible for the conflict. And until that government is gone, there will be no peace in Ukraine or Russia. And that's where we are headed right now. People need to understand this. I think they do, frankly, outside of Ukraine. I think there are preparations to fly Zelensky and much of his inner circle to Israel, where they have immunity against extradition for criminal proceedings. And that's what they're going to need when they finish up in Ukraine. They've got one foot right now in Ukraine and the other foot really in the door of the aircraft to fly them out. People don't realize how weak and fragile this Ukrainian government is. Earlier today, I received some information from Eastern Europe, and I was told that people are coming out of the basements and homes in Prokhorovsk, and they're saying, you know, to the Russians, thank God, let's get this over with, help end this war. And many of them are saying what initially back in 2022, in February, March, April, were saying in Luhansk and Donetsk, what took you so long? I think increasingly the population that lives in eastern Ukraine and much of the population in the West desperately wants an end to this war. And they realize it will only end with one outcome. That is the elimination of Zelensky and his regime. It's a permanent trigger for conflict and war. Now, that satisfies certain people in Washington, D.C., and the current globalist governments in Europe. But it is not a long-term solution for peace and stability in Europe. It's the opposite. So people like McConnell or Slotkin or Lindsey Graham, any of these people, they all sing the same tune. You know, somebody was saying the other day, well, the Republicans have made such a mess of this. The Democrats are going to end up taking over on the midterms, and then they'll probably win in 28. And I looked at it and I said, so what difference? What's the difference? That's the truth. These people are all playing more or less on the same team. And that's why you've got to go back and ask the question, how is it that you're a millionaire? How did you become a millionaire after you came to Washington, D.C.? Show us the sources of your cash. Pretty soon you discover it's the same source, the same people.
And you know, you have to look at the European contingent this minute. You mentioned them a second ago, but again, this it seems to me that Ukraine and Europe are driving the train. You said it should be the United States. We have the power, but it doesn't look like it is. So on top of everything I've already shown you here now, kind of representing the European side, is Keir Starmer yesterday before members of his parliament, or maybe it's this morning.
And Mr. Speaker, we should not forget that Putin's aggression, his illegal actions, and his total disregard for human life has taken a huge toll on his own people. Thousands of Russian soldiers are killed every single day. 100,000 have been killed attacking Donetsk. In total, more than 1 million Russians have been killed or injured, all because of the depraved ambitions of one man. So, Mr. Speaker, we say again, this country will never falter in our support for the Ukrainian people. We will maintain a unity of purpose with our allies, and we will focus on delivering the calm, serious leadership that is needed to advance a just and lasting peace for Ukraine, and indeed for the whole of Europe.
Doug, seriously, that speech could have been given on the first year of war when Biden was in office. I mean, they're virtually indistinguishable, meaning there's no change, as you just said.
Well, these are all lies. And the lies are the foundation for the failed policies that he and his colleagues in Europe have pursued. If he admits that the Russian losses are minuscule compared with the enormous losses of the Ukrainians, well, that undermines his argument. It would be the humane thing for him to do, because he's just flat out lying. None of that is true. It reminds me of the commitments that were made by Franklin Roosevelt and Churchill that said Poland will be a free, independent, democratic state at the end of this war. Well, you know what happened? No such thing. It's almost as ridiculous as Gerald Ford, who during his bid for election, when he ran for president after having succeeded Nixon, said that Poland will never be a Soviet satellite under a Ford administration. And of course, it had been a Soviet satellite since the end of the Second World War. Politicians lie all the time. They lie when it's impossible to do anything else because the truth is too dangerous. The truth is too destructive. Starmer is in a lot of trouble. He is the most universally hated person in the British Isles. He's not going to last. And frankly, Britain is in very serious financial as well as political trouble. If it all comes together, we could see something on the scale of the English Civil Wars. I commend everybody to listen to David Betts, who's studied the potential for revolutionary change in Great Britain now for many years. And his more recent works give great detail in support of what I've just said. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to Starmer. Macron won't be far behind, and neither will be Mertz in Berlin. These people are all on the road to extinction.
You know, part of the problem on Britain, I'll just kind of take a side street on this one, that you say there's a lot of political problems inside of UK. It's always been for decades and decades, it's been conservatives and Labour kind of going back and forth here. But now that the conservatives and Labour are kind of falling off on their own, going off onto one side here, where this now growing from the people from the bottom up is kind of bubbling up. And to show how disconnected they are from that is that the opposition leader, the conservative opposition leader, went also right after Starmer spoke to take issue with what he said. But you'll see that the issue that they took was that he's not going far enough.
Conservatives are clear that the blanket surrender of Ukrainian territory would mean rewarding Putin's unprovoked aggression. What is the government's position on reports that Ukraine's territorial integrity is on the table? Because if Putin is seen to emerge stronger from these negotiations, all our potential adversaries will be emboldened. Be in no doubt, Mr. Speaker, the axis of authoritarian states is collaborating to destabilize the West, aided by China, with Iran providing weapons and North Korea providing troops for Putin. It is precisely for these reasons that the government must continue to work extremely closely with the US and to understand their objectives. Parties like the Lib Dems and the Greens, who are encouraging us to decouple from the US, are putting their anti-American prejudice above national security.
So, I mean, they want to just decouple from anything that's going to take away from the gravy train as I see it. How do you see it?
Well, Britain has fallen on very hard times. None of these people are particularly competent, and it's unfortunate they seem to be suffering from a talent deficit as bad or worse than our own. Let me give you a quick example. In 1863, when Denmark declared war on Prussia and Austria over a territorial dispute, there was suddenly an outburst of patriotic fervor in England saying we should send our army to the Danish peninsula and help the Danes fight the Prussians and the Austrians. There was a very brilliant prime minister who came to power at the time. His name was Palmerston, a serious conservative and thoughtful man. And Palmerston said very cleverly to the gathered body, "We know that we can send 100,000 of our troops, which would have been virtually the whole British Army, to Denmark, and they would give a good account of themselves," to which everybody said, "Hear, hear, hear, hear," you know. He said, however, we also realize that however much we may like the Danes and want to help them, that 100,000 British troops are not going to rescue the Danes from eventual defeat by the Prussians and the Austrians. In fact, if we were to do this, the Prussians and the Austrians would mobilize their respective armed forces and their nations, and we could not compete with that. So it makes no sense for us to join this conflict. Now, stop and think about that. This is 1863. The British Empire in 1863 was far larger, far more powerful, far more extensive than British power today is, dramatically so. And yet that prime minister had the common sense and the intelligence to recognize the limitations of British power. And he knew that in 1863, together with the Danes, there was no chance of success against Prussia and Austria. We need more people with common sense and willingness to tell the truth in public. Instead, we have these false narratives that have been cooked up, you know, for years by MI6. We're talking about a level of control over the media, influence over the media, influence over what is discussed or isn't discussed in the West that really is worse than what I remember studying about the Soviets in the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 80s. That's pretty frightening if you stop and think about it. They have successfully crushed anyone who challenges anything in the narrative that they insist is true. It's not going to last much longer. The British, surprisingly, have proved as a population to be remarkably obedient, but it's coming to an end. I think we're going to see it end across Europe. And obviously, people will sit out there and say, "Well, Doug, you know, you said these things before." Yes, I have. And it's going to happen. But remember, the world is not an American microwave oven. You know, you say something, Americans, "Oh, well, that's happened now. It'll happen next week." If you tell Americans that if we go into Venezuela, that this could fatally damage us financially and economically, that it could undermine our position as the financial hegemon in the Western world, they say, "Oh, well, that's ridiculous. How could that happen?" But when it does happen in 6 months or 8 months or 9 months, whatever it turns out to be, everybody says, "Well, how could this have ever occurred? Why didn't we see this coming?" It's coming. Europe is going to fall apart and it's going to rebuild itself. It's going to be tough. It's going to be ugly. But eventually there will be new governments, and these new governments are going to be completely disinterested in any war with Russia under any circumstances. That's coming. Moscow knows it, and the Russians know it, and the Russians are going to complete the job. And this 28-point plan is absurd. You know, you might as well print it on toilet paper, because that's the best use for it at this point.
Well, and you mentioned the Russians. Also, you mentioned people being unable or unwilling to acknowledge the truth, and then the Russians who are willing to say what the reality is. The interesting thing to me is that in light of all of these physical realities, because everything always goes back to what's happening on the ground and the actual balance of power as opposed to just words, is remaining on the Russian side. And even with all the advantages actually on their side, you don't hear them coming out and blasting a lot of words of their own. In fact, you have Sergei Lavrov, who actually says, even after all this, even with this 28 and now 19-point plan, whatever it is, because we haven't seen the details yet, he's still saying, "We're willing to talk. However,
our assessment remains valid in the sense that the key provisions of Trump's plan are based on the understandings reached in Anchorage at the Russian-American summit in August of this year. And these principles are generally reflected in the plan, which we welcomed. President Putin mentioned this because after Anchorage, when we thought these understandings had already been formalized, there was a long pause, and now the pause has been interrupted by the introduction of this document. We have it, but it has not been officially transmitted to us through unofficial channels. But we are naturally ready, as the president said, to discuss specific wording, because a number of issues there, of course, require clarification."
and what their president Putin has said in wearing military fatigues the other day in front of his military guys. He said, we will accomplish all of our military objectives, all of them, either by negotiations or by military. So that's where the Russians seem to be. What is that going to manifest on the ground?
Well, we've already seen a lot of evidence that the pace of operations has picked up. We now know that Russian forces have between themselves and the Dnieper River essentially open rolling terrain. The ball is truly in Russia's court. Moscow has to decide what it wants to do. The longer the stupidity drags on in Western Europe, the more threats that are made against Russia, the more likely it is that the Russians conclude that the only safety they can aspire to is the complete taking of territory up to the Dnieper River, because they'll see the Dnieper River as a natural barrier, a natural defensive line. That's what they'll do. And I still say that whatever happens, they will end up with both Odessa and Kharkov that are historically Russian cities, not Ukrainian. And when those cities are in their hands, they may be willing to talk about alternatives to the status quo, but not much until they get there. So I think the Russians now have the ability to end this by the end of the year on terms that they find acceptable. They would prefer what I discussed earlier for these governments in London and Paris and Berlin to change, and they may. There's a real potential for that. But in the meantime, they're just going to have to press ahead, and they can expect nothing from us. And by the way, the interesting part is, you know, President Trump has largely walked away from this business. I mean, he's willing to say, here's a 28-point plan, go look at it. But he's not really interested in it. Why is he not really interested? Because he can't be at the center of it. Remember, President Trump's all about optics. If this does not create the illusion that he wants, that somehow or another he's settled his, whatever it is, 19th war, whatever count he's aspiring to, yeah. If he can't say that, then he's not really interested anyway. So I think he'll play it off, which is what he's effectively done with these promises of more military assistance to Ukraine. Most of that material will not arrive for a year, 2 years, or longer. By the time that happens, there won't be a Ukraine unless somebody wakes up quickly and recognizes that they need a new government in Kiev, and the one that's there is a permanent obstacle to peace. Who knows? Everything is possible. It's not impossible. Something like that could happen. But right now, the Russians have to assume no change in the near term, which means they march west.
Well, so what do you think would happen? We'll take a look at this from both domestic and Western European political interest in both. For Trump, so he's put this number out there, whatever it turns out to be, whatever agreement they're going to want to come to. There is, in my view, literally no chance that Russia would agree to any of it, as long as what that this member of the parliament, the Ukraine, said a second ago is any indication. They're not going to agree to any of those kind of terms. So that means that after all this plays out like it did after Anchorage, it's just going to be nothing, and we're going to be right back where we were, except that the Russians will not be where they are now, because they'll keep moving to the west, as you said. What will this do to Trump's status if he still said he was trying to get this done, and then no deal comes out, and the Russians continue moving to the west?
He knows that the average American that has to cast a vote at some point for or against him and his administration, whether it happens next year, in the near-term, midterm elections, or it happens in 2028, he knows that the average American will pay no attention to what happens in Ukraine. Just won't. The average American says, well, you know, it's unfortunate what's happened in Ukraine, but President Trump has wisely stayed out of it. In his mind, there are no U.S. forces involved. As long as there are no U.S. forces involved, he doesn't particularly care. I think the problem is larger, because I think it's also financial. This has cost us a lot of money. You know, I think it was Fulbright many years ago who said, first you talk about millions, then hundreds of millions, then hundreds of billions. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. Well, we're now in the business of talking about real money. We have wasted billions and billions and billions. We have a $1 trillion defense budget, For what? To do what? You know, the whole ship of state is adrift. There's no one at the helm. President Trump is standing at the stern saying, hey, how about a little to the right or a little bit to the left? But there's no fundamental change in destination, no fundamental change in direction. That's the problem. And the destination is vague. The destination is, oh, well, we'll grow economically and we'll combat the debt. Oh, well, you know, we'll be able to weather these storms because we're the greatest, we're the most powerful, and so forth. But there is no firm destination. His destination, the one for which he was elected, is no more wars and end the ones we've got. He hasn't done that. It's deal with the issues here at home. Deal with the drops in income that have been afflicting the working class in this country for decades. Deal with the absence of jobs. Stop the influx of foreigners. Stop the H-1B visas. Stop the criminality. Those are the things that he said he would do, and he hasn't. In fact, he just announced, well, you know, my base won't like it, but I'll have to deal with that. We'll let these Saudis come in, and they'll have whatever visas they need. And so, what? The Saudis? Why are we bending over backwards to help those people? How does this help us? Where is the payoff? You know, forget it. You know, you could turn almost anybody, whether it's Honda or the Germans and Mercedes or Audi. They'll be happy to come over here and build and employ hundreds of thousands of U.S. workers. Yet Saudi Arabia says, well, we have to bring our own workers and we have to have our own management and everything else. He says, oh, that's okay. How many times do Americans have to feel betrayed before they finally wake up and say, thank you, but no thank you? And they need to understand that if you think you're going to get something different out of the other side, you're wrong.
Yeah.
You're not. It's going to be just as bad.
Yeah, we've seen that play out a lot, but I guess we'll have to wait and see how that's going to happen. Listen, before I let you go, I actually want to shift base to something that you mentioned a minute ago, and that is the situation in Venezuela, because there continues to be growing physical evidence that we are on the verge of doing something inside of Venezuela, not just taking out drug boats in the Caribbean Sea, but actually taking some sort of action. There was another B-52 rehearsal run, some are calling it, just about 48 hours ago. What do you see happening there?
If you look at the enormous buildup of American military power, whether it is offshore in the Caribbean or the buildup of forces on Puerto Rico that ostensibly will be eventually transported south into Venezuela, it strikes me as very, very unlikely that the president of the United States will suddenly announce after Thanksgiving, I've changed my mind. We've come into an agreement with Venezuela. We're not going in. I just don't see that happening. I think at some point you cross the proverbial Rubicon. The buildup of U.S. military power is enormous, and I think the temptation to use it is overwhelming. And remember that at least in the latest polls that I've seen, roughly 70% of Americans polled have expressed opposition to the idea of going into Venezuela with military power. They don't want another war, and they don't want a war in the Caribbean. They don't want a war with Venezuela. Doesn't make any difference. And I think there's an assumption, a set of assumptions, I haven't seen them all, that suggests that this will be quick, decisive, and successful. And the attitude is, if it's quick, decisive, and successful, no one will complain. And if we have casualties, there'll be very few. That's one assumption. The second assumption is, if it's not quick, decisive, and immediately successful, well, we'll get the rally around the flag effect. Americans will say, well, we have to support the president, we have to support our troops, and so forth. I think both assumptions are false. I don't think it's going to be quick, decisive, and easy. And I don't know the details of how we're going to install Mrs. Machado and replace Maduro. I have no idea. I do know the difficulties of the terrain, the difficulties of going into Caracas from the coast, the numerous places where air and missile defense forces can be placed, but that have been generously made available by the Russians. We also know that many of the strike missiles that the Russians have arrived in Venezuela, could be used against offshore vessels, ships, and so forth. It may be that our intelligence is telling the president that we can identify everything wherever it is. We can, you know, preempt by striking all of these locations. I don't know. I mean, you'd have to sit in there and listen to these briefings, but you always have to examine for any operation the assumptions. You can live or die on the base of assumptions. And I don't know what those are, but if those are being crafted honestly, we wouldn't go.
And what is even the public claim about this? I mean, you seems like you can't go down this road of, oh, it's illegal drugs and we're going to pick Venezuela out of all of the places where a lot of these illegal drugs do originate or how they get into our country. Would the American people just say and shrug a shoulder if we go into yet another war that's clearly not in our national interest, about which we have no threats? Nobody from Venezuela is threatening America. And this connection with this so-called Maduro as being a narco terrorist leader, et cetera. I don't know that that's going to wear very well in the American people. How do you see that?
Well, the president talks about the Venezuelan criminals, the drug gangs, human trafficking organizations that came into the United States that murdered American citizens, the girls who were brutally raped and murdered by these Venezuelan gangs. Well, he's right. And the people responsible for that are sitting on the Hill, as well as Mr. Biden and his administration. They are the ones that opened our borders. Remember, Bill Clinton was interviewed about it, and he said, well, what do you expect? None of these people were vetted before we allowed them to come into the country. Well, Bill Clinton accidentally spoke the truth. The problem is that it's too late now. We have millions of them in our country, and instead of focusing on getting those people out, which is absolutely essential, in my judgment, to the survival of the republic as we know it, because our republic survives or fails on the basis of enforcing the law. The rule of law in our country has always been our greatest virtue. Even when we, from time to time, failed miserably, we ultimately came around to understanding what was right, what was wrong, and we enforced the law. For some reason, we're not doing that. Pointing to a little ICE raid in one corner of Los Angeles or a little ICE raid in a corner of Chicago, that's not an answer. Where is the national strategy to deal with this problem? That should be the centerpiece of his administration. It's not. Instead, we're trying to do what Netanyahu wants in the Middle East and what the same donors that want us involved in the Middle East want us to do in Eastern Europe. And I suppose some of those are also involved in dragging us into Venezuela. There seems to be the unspoken assumption that if we get in there, we can take over the oil and the gas, go into whatever rare earths they have. In other words, we can capture control of all these resources. Well, in order to do that, you're going to have to secure all those locations. And that assumes that the insurgents that may not go along with your idea can't really harm you and won't present a real threat. See, the problem is that it tends to dismiss out of hand that anybody in Venezuela has any sense of national identity or any sense of patriotism or devotion to their country. I doubt that. I think that the Venezuelans actually do have a strong national identity. They have a history. They're very proud of having won their independence from the Spaniards and fought that war. And I think they're going to be more prepared than we think to fight us. And I just don't see that as being a good outcome. I don't see it at all. Again, as we've discussed before, I like Shakespeare's famous words, take the deal. Maduro offered a deal, take the deal. But there's so much more wrapped up in this, as this is being billed as a strategic screw you from the United States to Moscow and Beijing, that somehow or another we're sending this magical signal that says we're in charge in this hemisphere and you can't come in. We may end up looking foolish and stupid, demonstrating that we really aren't in charge in the Western Hemisphere at all, and that we have multiplied our opponents and enemies in Latin America, you know, 100-fold as a result of our actions. I don't know. I just don't think it's worth the risk.
Well, yeah, that's kind of where I'm coming down on that too. I mean, there's to me literally no potential upside. I don't see any potential upside, but there's a lot of downside. If this goes south, I mean, this could literally just derail the remainder of the Trump administration. No matter how long he stays in, no matter what happens with Congress in the midterms, I mean, this could just completely undo him if it goes south. And there's a real possibility that it could, but I don't know that he's going to listen to that. I guess we'll have to wait and see. You mentioned something about Israel, though. I want to finish on that too, because there were some elections coming up in Israel, and a lot of people were thinking, okay, since we're kind of in a modified ceasefire and kind of ended the Gaza war here, now things are kind of cooling down, and so now then probably with these elections, Netanyahu's going to get ousted, and things can continue moving on down the peace plan. That's what some people think. What do you think?
I think three things. First, these elections will not result in Netanyahu's removal from office. Number two, however much many Israelis may or may not like Netanyahu, certainly to the tune of at least 80% of the electorate, they support his policies. All you have to do is look at the public outcry against any legal action against the soldiers in the Israeli army who were caught on film raping and brutalizing Palestinian prisoners, men and women. Lastly, they really want the Greater Israel Project to succeed, and they know that Mr. Netanyahu has control of our government and especially of Mr. Trump. Why would you toss Mr. Netanyahu onto the ash heap of history when he delivers absolute control over the United States, its government, its leadership, and its armed forces? You're not going to do that. So I think he will stay in power. And after he regains power, I think he's going to double down on his goals. Very recently, we saw the Israelis bomb in Lebanon. The Israelis continue to kill people in Gaza and also on the West Bank. So I don't see anything changing for the better from that standpoint. In fact, I think it's going to become more dangerous.
And what direction could that go? How could it get worse? Because if the Greater Israel Project is still on the table for many in Israel, that means the expulsion one way or another of the people in Gaza, which at least for the moment in this alleged peace plan that Trump brought, ended that prospect. How do you see that unfolded?
Well, I call it the Kushner-Lutnick Witkoff plan for Gaza and Israel continues without interruption. There is no real ceasefire. There have been pauses from time to time. There has been a diminishment of intensity. But as soon as this election is over and Netanyahu is once again confirmed in power, I fully expect the intensity to pick up. And if anything, they will try to finish the job as soon as possible. Remember, the weather over there right now is terrible. People are dying from disease, from exposure. So there's no reason to give up at this stage if you're an Israeli. Your goal is to kill or expel these people. At the same time, you've had the United States government essentially buy off the Arab states in the region. The Emirates aren't going to intervene to stop anything. They're worried about survival. They have no real military power. The same is true for Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are now buying F-35s. Gosh, why would the Saudis buy F-35s? And if the Israelis were concerned about that, they would stop it. They would simply tell everyone in Congress, absolutely not. We don't want the F-35s in Saudi hands. They're not worried about it. Now, where should they worry? Well, they've got this man, Jalani, who is now in charge in much of Syria. He seems to be the compromise candidate between Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Erdogan. In other words, they both wanted to get rid of Assad, and we have brokered a sort of unofficial agreement between Israel and Turkey that the Turks and the Israelis will share hegemony over the region. Mr. Jalani sits at the center of that. And for the moment, the Kurds, who play a role in Syria, have been pacified by us and the Israelis, told to stand down and not provoke anybody. Now, all of this is held together with bubblegum and string. This is not a permanent outcome by any means. That's why I usually compare the agreement, unofficial agreement for joint hegemony between the Turks and the Israelis as similar to the Nazi-Soviet pact. And I expect that that will break down. The more aggressive the Israelis become in Lebanon, in Syria, the more likely that is to happen. Mr. Netanyahu has not mentioned it, but members of his cabinet have spoken openly about taking control of Damascus. That's a dead end as far as Israel is concerned from the Turkish standpoint. The Turks will fight against that. And there are a lot of Turks who are very uncomfortable with what's been going on. But the Turks want their economy to continue to grow stronger. They have a huge military industrial base now. I think they're number one or number two in the world in terms of supplying unmanned aerial vehicles around the world. So the Turks have come a long way militarily. They don't want to sacrifice that unnecessarily. So they will go along to a certain point. I just don't know what that point is. And then at the same time, you have Iran. And Iran must be destroyed if you're an Israeli. They have signed on for that. They will do everything in their power to bring on that conflict and include us in it, because Iran stands in the way of their absolute hegemonic domination of the Middle East.
Well, that's not a good way to enter into this year and head into the next, but we have what we have. And as always, we're really grateful to you coming on and providing us the clarity so that we understand what we're facing here, and especially we here in the United States. At least we get a shot to have our voices heard by our representatives or anybody else that we want to push out there to say, don't go down this path. It's bad for us economically. It's bad for us national security wise. And we just have to hope that some of those voices gain some ascendancy. But we are grateful for your voice. Thank you so much, Doug.
Well, happy Thanksgiving.
We're happy and we are thankful to have voices like yours out here. So we do have something to be thankful for. And also to let everybody know we are on podcast. So you can be thankful for that too. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive and you will find us waiting there for you. Also, we're on Substack at DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com. And you can find us there. Also, don't go too far away because we're going to get into some of the details of what this alleged 19-point peace plan is from the Russian perspective with Stanislav Krapivnik back with us today to much acclaim from our audience here. Don't miss that. Just 30 minutes from now, 1:30 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and we'll see you then.